We're making more money.
But we're spending more money, too.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Adrian Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, the 1st of March.
Coming up, we'll explain the wealth gap in America.
We'll look at the impact sanctions are having on Syria.
And Justin Bieber turns 18, which means he'll finally get his millions.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The government said this morning that the number of people applying for unemployment benefits stayed about the same last week at 351,000. That is a four-year low. Also this morning, the Commerce Department said that our incomes were up 0.3% in January. And here to talk about that with us is Gus Fauché. He is senior macroeconomist with PNC Financial, and he's with us now from Philadelphia. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gus, we're making a little bit more money.
That's right. We're seeing both job gains, more people working, and then we're also seeing wage growth. People are being paid a little bit more who have jobs. And so together, those are contributing to income gains that we're seeing.
How big of a deal is 0.3% in a month?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, that averages around 3.5-4% over a year, so that's okay. It's not great, you know, particularly if inflation is running at around 2%. So real growth, you know, there is about 2%, which is again, that's okay. But certainly, we'd like to see something stronger than that, more job growth, and then stronger wage gains as well.
Well, you mentioned price inflation. I mean, you don't have to go far here in Los Angeles to find gas almost at $5 a gallon. Prices are going up. How much of that money are we just going to throw right back into rising costs of things?
Well, there's no question but that higher gasoline prices are going to be a hit on budgets. But there are some advantages we've been seeing. Natural gas prices are way down. It's been a warm winter throughout the U.S., so that's reduced home heating costs. So we've seen some relief there. But it is going to be the case that inflation and higher energy prices in particular are going to take a hit out of some of those wage gains.
Gus Fauché, senior economist with PNC Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the fact that incomes rose 0.3% probably won't do much to reduce the wealth gap in this country. And that wealth gap is the subject of today's story as we launch our Wealth and Poverty Desk.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
Now, when I say wealth gap, I'm talking about the growing concentration of money for people at the top, while those in the middle and the bottom lose ground. Our story this morning comes from Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Back in 1979, the top 10% of earners took home about a third of the nation's income. By the late 2000s, half that income was flowing into their paychecks. Another way to look at it, as the economy grew, fully 80% of the increase in our incomes went to the top 1%. Everyone else, well, not doing so well, says NYU economist Edward Wolfe.
The middle class has basically been experiencing stagnating income and, it turns out, stagnating wealth as well. So the benefits of economic growth have become almost totally concentrated in the hands of the rich.
But not everyone agrees gains for the rich come at the expense of the poor and middle class. Scott Winship of the Brookings Institution told a Senate committee recently, consider Mark Zuckerberg. He could make billions off Facebook stock.
How would the typical American end up better off if Zuckerberg could not exercise those options? American inequality levels are viscerally bracing. But one still has to make the case that they are undesirable.
A lot of people are making the case for undesirable. They point to growing disparities in healthcare and education and economic mobility. Timothy Smeeding at the University of Wisconsin's Institute for Research on Poverty says a growing economy that leaves so many stuck at the middle or bottom tears at the social fabric. And he says it's getting ever harder for the have-nots to move up the ladder.
Most low-income people do not begrudge the haves. Hey, he had a smart idea. He went out and worked hard. That's great. I want my son to have the same chance. But the problem is they're increasingly realizing that their children will not have the same chance. That means the American dream is shaking right now.
The stronger job growth we've seen lately could expand the economic pie again, but few economists see the slice the rich get served up getting any smaller. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So how is income inequality playing with the American public? It's time for our weekly attitude check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Gallup editor-in-chief Frank Newport joins us now, as he does every Thursday. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
Where do people believe the middle class begins and ends?
There is no official data from the Census Bureau, so we don't know that way. Sociologists have tried to figure it out for many, many years. The way we do it here at Gallup is we simply ask people, you know, what class are you in? We give them a list of class, and the middle class is actually very popular. Almost half of Americans say, yes, I'm in the middle class. That's a very broad group of people based on their income. And actually another 17% say I'm in the upper middle class, so that's about two-thirds of Americans who put themselves in the middle class. Very, very few people want to say they're upper class. Very, very few people say they want a lower class. The rest of the people that aren't middle class like the words working class.
Now, at what point income-wise do people say, yep, I'm wealthy, I'm upper class?
You know, that's in the eye of the beholder. But if you really look at the broad spectrum, how much money do you need to make to be rich? $150,000 is the median. That is, half of Americans say something that's under $150,000 a year income would make them rich, and half say something over that. But the data show if you make $30,000 a year, then aspirationally you look up and say, if only I could make $150,000 a year, I would be rich.
I want to ask about the wealth gap, which is growing right now between the very rich and the very poor. Is that something voters care about?
You know, most voters don't overall. We gave Americans a long list of about 9 different issues that they could take into account in voting, and lowering that gap between the rich and the poor was 7th out of the 9. The only two things that were lower in priority were immigration and moral issues. So it's not a high priority on average. However, that masks the fact that underneath there, if you're a Democrat and liberal, all of a sudden it shoots way up because they're responding to President Obama's emphasis on lowering the gap between the rich and the poor. But for independents and Republicans, particularly Republicans, it's a very low priority issue.
Gallup's Frank Newport, thanks.
My pleasure.
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now to the global perspective on business and economics. We start in North Korea, which has reached a deal with the U.S. to suspend its nuclear program in exchange for U.S. food aid. Because of sanctions, the U.S. hasn't sent food to Korea since 2009, despite reports of significant malnutrition in the country. For more, we go to the BBC's Lucy Williamson in South Korea. Good morning.
Morning.
So as part of the deal, the U.S. has released hundreds of millions of pounds in food aid to North Korea. How significant is that to the people living there?
It depends who they reach, is the short answer. And one of the things that's held up that food aid from the American point of view is ensuring they can get proper access to monitor where it's going. They're worried any food they give North Korea may be diverted to feed the enormous army they have there and not go to the people who, we are told by aid agencies, are severely malnourished in some parts of the country.
Now, are there any provisions in place to make sure the food gets to the right people?
The U.S. State Department is saying that they have got assurances that their monitors will be able to get to have the access they need. That's, of course, a hugely wide-open question. I mean, this takes us to a situation where you've got a broad agreement between North Korea and the U.S. about what will happen, but you don't have much of the nitty-gritty fleshed out yet, and that's where a lot of these agreements fall down. I mean, certainly much larger deals than this one have been scuppered by the detail.
How big a deal is this agreement to U.S. relations in Asia broadly?
The U.S.-North Korea relationship is at the center of a lot of what goes on here, and this agreement gets us to the starting line, if you like. It's a real turnaround in where we were, but it is only the starting line. It's like everyone's got back in the car and they're staring down the road, you know, but there's a long road to go, and as I say, lots of things could trip this up along the way.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson. Thanks.
Thanks.
The UN Human Rights Council voted today to condemn the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. The council says the regime's attacks against its own citizens may amount to crimes against humanity. Now, that resolution carries no legal weight. And so far, the international community's main weapon against Syria's government has been economic sanctions. Both the U.S. and the European Union currently ban the import of Syrian oil. But some countries, like Russia, continue to do business with Syria. For more on this, let's bring in Samir Seyfan. He's a Syrian economist who fled the country last year. He joins us now from Dubai. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, there are a host of economic sanctions against Syria right now from both the U.S. and Europe. Are they doing anything?
Yes, actually, just for an example, if you take the crude oil production, which is very important for Syria, last year it was 358,000 barrels per day, and now reduced to 220,000 barrels per day. There is no export crude oil. This means the revenue of this export is disappeared. There is not enough oil product to produce, to generate electricity for cars, for heating, for industry, for normal life. So the impact is very, very, very tough, actually.
What do you expect to happen in Syria in the coming months? Do you think Assad is going to hold on to power?
Actually, this is depend on many factors, depend on Russia. If Russia is still supporting him and the Western country start to intervene in Syria, we expect to finish the issue within 2 to 3 months. Hmm. If the situation still like this, the struggle will take 1 year. In this case, the country will lose a lot. The damage would be very, very high.
Samir Seyfan is a Syrian economist with the Orient Research Center. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for you also.
Bank of America is looking to charge new fees for checking accounts. According to the Wall Street Journal, the bank is currently testing different fee models, including monthly charges of anywhere from $6 to $25. That's after B of A had to back off a plan last year to charge people to use their debit cards. Now, there's no word on when customers might start getting dinged with the extra fee, but we thought we'd call up Brett King. He's the author of Bank 2.0, a book about the future of banking. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning.
So tell me a little bit more about the fees Bank of America is considering.
So they're looking at basic checking account fees to be introduced. What they'll probably do is say that if you get certain benefits, if you use channels like the online and mobile channels rather than just being an over-the-counter customer within a branch, I think this is a reflection of the changing distribution costs in the business as well.
Now, do you expect other banks are going to follow with their own new fees?
It's likely that there are others just waiting to see how this is responded to in the market. And if B of A get away with it, then others undoubtedly will be happy to follow.
Now, what's the likelihood B of A will get away with it? They did get a lot of blowback about those ATM fees last year.
So the thing that's different with this is they're basically saying if you behave in this way, then you won't get fees, but if you don't, then you will. There are precedents for this. Other markets such as the UK, Australia and so forth did this with basic checking accounts many, many years ago, and there was pushback, but eventually the fees held. So, but we live in a different world today. The sort of social transparency aspect could make this a very tough move for B of A.
Brett King is the author of Bank 2.0. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Waiting around for the cable guy to show up can be a troublesome experience, Adrian, if not simply annoying. I don't know if it's happened to you. It's certainly happened to me before.
It makes me crazy. It makes me crazy.
Well, the Wall Street Journal reports today that more than half of all adults used a sick day or a vacation day to wait at home for a service or delivery. And, of course, that means they're not working and they're having to use their leisure time for something that's probably
something.
Not very leisurely.
Yes.
To talk more about this for our Midday Extra today, we have Rebecca Wedeman. She's Vice President of Nucleus Research, and she's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So how does this wait time that we all sit at home waiting for the cable guy or whoever affect our productivity?
Well, I think we've seen people get more stressed and recognize that 2 or 3 hours, it's not just the waiting time, it's the predictability of when people will arrive. Anyone under 40 years old is used to being able to text people immediately and get a status update. They expect the same from someone they're paying for a service.
Now, are there economic factors to this wait other than the fact we're taking some time off work?
Well, I think there are economic factors, Adrian, and what we're seeing on the company side is that for every dollar a customer service firm spends on support, they get $5.60 back in returns. So they're looking at investing in technology to cut those service times, makes them more profitable, and it means frustrated consumers spend less time on Yelp and Twitter.
Now, the Journal story this morning reports that some companies are trying to whittle down the wait window from about 4 hours to about 2 hours, which I guess would be twice as good for consumers.
Half the time.
Do you think that's going to make a big difference?
Well, if you figure a 40-hour work week, 2 hours is 5% of productivity. So that will certainly be respected by a lot of customers. The other thing to remember is the number of folks that will wait for 3 hours and 45 minutes and then give up. And that's where it really starts to cost the Comcast of the world money if they send a truck rolling and there's nobody there to receive the call.
Now, you mentioned Yelp and Facebook before, and I wonder what kind of impact those social media sites are having when it comes to companies looking to improve customer service in this way.
Well, I think the opportunity, what we've seen is everyone who has a bad experience can viralize it pretty quickly, whether it's Yelp, Twitter, Facebook. The consumer has, there are a number of sites available. So Comcast, for all the money it may spend on search engine optimization and marketing, for every dollar it spends, it can get a lot more back if it's actually able to address customers when they complain online.
What's the longest you've ever waited for the cable guy?
I'm one of those, if you're not there by 3 hours and 45 minutes, I'm out, Jeremy.
Yeah, you know, I feel the same way. Once when I was living in New York, I had a cable appointment. They were supposed to be there between 8 and noon. I took the morning off of work. They didn't come. They called at 11:50. They said, we'll be there at 2 in the afternoon. I said, forget it. I'm not going to get cable anymore. And I relied on the PBS NewsHour thereafter.
Good for you.
All right. Yeah, I showed them. Rebecca Wedderman, VP of Nucleus Research. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The online review site Yelp will start selling stock to the public tomorrow. And Facebook, which is early in the IPO process, is working to woo its own potential investors. The social network has announced new advertising plans. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins tells us what it'll mean for users. And here's a hint. It's kind of annoying.
Take the ad campaign for Titanic. It's about to be re-released in 3D.
I'm the king of the world!
Facebook marketing executive Mike Hofflinger says that trailer may now appear in multiple places on Facebook in the news feeds of
Titanic's 17 million global fans and their 700 million friends.
I'm the king of the world!
On the pages users see when they log out of Facebook.
I'm the king of the world!
And in the feeds on their cell phones and tablets. Deborah Aho Williamson is with eMarketer.
They have never had advertising on mobile device before, which is way overdue in my opinion.
Mike Barrett of media buyer Universal McCann says there may have been a reason Facebook's been waiting.
They do run the risk of cluttering people's news feeds.
And of squandering their position as
king of the world!
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Today, one of the richest teenagers in the world turns 18. I am talking, of course, Adrian, about Justin Bieber, who's...
Baby,
exactly.
Baby.
Yes, please.
No
more.
Longer a baby, right?
Not a baby anymore. His net worth is somewhere around $100 million. So we wondered, what happens to the money when a child star becomes an adult star? And, of course, what happens to the star? We sent Sabri Benishore out looking for answers.
Actually, Justin is going to need somebody to manage his finances.
A lot's going to change for Justin Bieber when he turns 18 because he will have access to his money.
Susie Maines is a talent agent who's worked with young stars. Kids in showbiz, by law, have 15% of their earnings put into what's called a Coogan account. Nobody can touch it except the star at age 18.
Sometimes it can actually, you know, show us who the child is.
Maine says it is no coincidence that some of the biggest celebrity meltdowns happen to child stars after they turn 18. TJ Stein is also a longtime agent. He says,
it depends on the families, it depends on how they were educated, and it depends on the kid.
For Justin and his millions, whatever happens, it'll be one heck of a birthday party. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
And finally, to a man in Brazil who tried to use a fake ID to open a bank account and got caught. Not because the ID card looked fake, but because the photo on it was actor Jack Nicholson. And apparently the people behind the counter had seen some Jack Nicholson movies. So they figured out that probably wasn't right. In fact, Brazilian police say there is no resemblance between the suspect, who's 41, and Nicholson, who is 74. So maybe he should have picked somebody else.
I just wonder how in the world you choose Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, well, you know, he's right at the front row at the Oscars every time.
You're
so
right.
That could be it. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.